The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchel.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique. Except again, this one is slightly different.
For those of you who've seen the title and are tuning in expecting to hear Thomas Barnard back from the grave, unfortunately, it is just us again. And Thomas Barnard's most recent translator, Douglas Robertson.
Douglas joined us from Keystone in Florida, where we decided to approach him, speak to him, as we're Lachlan and I are both fans of Thomas Barnard's work. And I had been trying to track down for a long time all of the novels in translation, and the Cheap Eaters was the sort of stubborn one that, although there was an English translation extant somewhere, it was just never available. I think occasionally you might see it online for 200 quid or something. So I noticed that Spurl Editions, the American publisher, were bringing out a new translation of the Cheap Eaters, which would fill that hole. So I thought we'd approach them and see if we could speak to the translator. Douglas kindly agreed to join us. Douglas, thank you for joining us. We're speaking to you just ahead of the publication of your translation of Thomas Barnard's The Cheap Eaters. I guess to start off with, I'd just like to ask you a little bit about your background in translation and how you came to work on this book.
Well, first of all, I should say I'm sort of a Thomas Barnard fan. My Thomas Barnard fandom exceeds my biography as a translator by about 10 years. I've been reading Thomas Barnard since the late 1990s. And back then, I basically read everything I could get a hold of by him that had been translated. And in the meantime, I'd become interested in German literature, almost just sort of stumbled into it in the original German. I mean, I'd been interested also more broadly in German literature in translation since adolescence. So I initially just started sort of translating German as a kind of hobby about 15 years ago. But I started with the Romantics, people like E.T.A. Hoffmann and Ludwig Tieck, and didn't really consider dealing with Barnhart until much later. I mean, I went to the Cheap Eaters. That was one of the ones that I couldn't get hold of, because we'll probably address this in more detail later. It wasn't available in translation, so I thought I might as well try translating it myself. I found it a little too rough going back then, about 10 years ago. And eventually, after I translated much more German in from earlier periods in history, mainly, I finally circled back to Barnhart and just started translating everything that hadn't been translated that I could find by him, just sort of, again, on my own as a kind of hobby. But at the same time, being in touch with people who were also interested in Barnhart in German literature. And eventually, one of those people, an editor at Spurl, took an interest in translating something of mine, one of my Barnhart translations.
Have you always spoken German? Were you raised bilingual, or how?
By no means. My knowledge of German was picked up by happenstance, mainly through listening to music and Lieder and Schubert Lieder, Mahler Lieder, things like that, and movies and like the German New Wave, the New German Cinema.
Is that something you were brought up with? Was it sort of around you in your formative years, or was it something that you kind of came across it through choices that you'd made? Or
I don't know. It was, in a way, I mean, it was, but in a sort of, it was mixed in with a lot of other things. Like, I remember seeing the G.W. Pabst adaptation of Die Dreigroschenoper, the Threepenny Opera, on the local public television station when I was about 18. And that was just one of the ways you might encounter it. or hearing Lulu, Alban Berg's Lulu, the Metropolitan Opera broadcast, that kind of thing. Not, it wasn't really a part of my core education, though.
And did you go on to sort of study German academically, or is this all from just an interest in the literature that's led you to learning the language?
Again, not officially, although I read a lot of German literature, mostly in translation, throughout college, and did study German briefly in graduate school as part of a language requirement. But I didn't really get into studying the language too much until after graduate school.
And is Austria, I mean, I know Swiss German is very different. Is Austrian German quite different to standard German?
Well, it all depends on from which direction you're approaching it. I think there are differences in the literary language itself that are very hard to get hold of without resorting to cliches about musicality versus an orientation to efficient communication and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Verbally, orally, it's quite different, but you don't tend to notice that unless someone is trying to approximate the dialogue or the spoken, the sound of the spoken language, which Bernhard tends not to do. So when dealing with Bernhard, it's not a big issue. He often uses words that are specifically used only in Austria for one reason or another, but the dictionaries tend to be pretty good about covering those. So you don't really have to worry too much about not finding a particular word because it's not used by in Hochdeutsch or, you know, in Germany, in the Federal Republic. On the other hand, I also have been translating recently Hermann Lentz, who is a contemporary of Bernhard's, who is from Swabia in southern Germany, and there's quite a bit of difference.
They've got, it's quite the dialect down there. I have my partner's brother went out there with his family, and he was saying that his son growing up there was learned. He would teach Schwabian as a separate language. Basically, he said he's learning German and he's learning what they speak here.
Right. So the point is, I guess, and so this is a writer, Lentz, goes out of his way to emphasize the dialectal differences between Swabian German and standard German. And so it's to some extent up at the discretion of the writer, because he has a lot of dialogue, and a lot of it is just basically phonetically rendered, and it takes ages just to track down the word in standard German that it's approximating. Now, with Bernhard, it is an issue when you're reading interviews with him, or there's this sort of diary that I'm translating by his next-door neighbor, where he approximates the sound of Bernhard's spoken Austrian German, and often he does it phonetically, and then that produces somehow, that sometimes makes tracking down the something approximate in English rather difficult. I mean, specifically when you're trying to get the specific nuances of a colloquialism, whether to make it really earthy or just slightly earthy. But most of that doesn't make it into Bernhard's prose, which is very, as you'll be aware, almost entirely lacking in what we think of as standard dialogue. Even though it is spoken, or it has the cadences of speech, but it's not. It's also meant to be understood as written at the same time. You're not really reading a transcript of the speech. You're reading someone's written account of what he remembers somebody saying, which is, and this is something we could also get into. It's not in quotes. It's rendered in the original by the use of the subjunctive, which tells you that it's, he's saying, he said this, he said that I did this, and so on, but, or that this happened, but he's not quoting verbatim what the other person said.
Yeah, I mean, it is a monologue, isn't it? But it's, yeah, as you say, it's like a written record. I hadn't ever thought of it quite that way.
Yeah, there's a sort of specificity about, you know, it is, Austria is a sort of time and place. It's not, you know, Buenos Aires in the 1940s. But at the same time, a lot of the feel of it is not so, it doesn't feel specific. It feels just like a sort of, a flow that could exist in lots of people's heads in a way. I mean, it's very specific to Thomas Bernhard as well, but it's almost a level before the sort of slang or dialect that you would expect with direct speech. for the reader anyway. I've not translated anything by Barnard at all, but it's an interesting balance that it feels there's an element of speech, but it feels divorced from speech.
Yes. And that's curious when you consider that he devoted a great deal of his output to plays, which are all speech, but in which there's also a lot of quoting of what other people say. So even in his plays, it's not exactly dialogue. I don't know if you're familiar with any of those, but...
No, I mean, are there any that are really available in translation? I've only read novels and almost all of them now, but his plays, which sound quite interesting, there don't seem to be certainly readily available English translations of them.
You're probably right as far as their availability goes. I would say about a third of them have already been translated and published at some time or another, but the translations have often, of most of them, I think, have gone out of print. There's a collection called Histrionics that came out about 30 years ago that has three or four of them, three or four of the better ones together. And I managed to get a hold of it about 10 years ago. So that one, I think you can still get a hold of a used copy of, but the majority of them haven't been translated into English yet, or at least published, officially published is in English.
Mm-hmm. That's possible future fertile ground if anyone, I mean, I don't know, maybe translating a play might be full of completely different traps and obstacles compared to translating a novel. I don't know.
Yes. In his case, there are some, well, I'm just going to say I have translated some of them, just that they haven't seen the light of day yet, but they do present other problems. But I guess we should try to focus on the pros for now.
Sure, yeah. So I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about how you approach that, because it sounds like it was a process that took place over quite a long time. So how did you just begin? I mean, did you sit down at the start and just get a dictionary out and start translating it that way? Or did you have particular passages that you thought would be good as a sample?
It's a little hard to remember exactly how I approached this particular translation from the very beginning, because it's been more than 4 years since I wrote the first draft. But basically, with Barnhart, the sentences are so long that the best thing to do is just take a sentence and try to make sense of that particular sentence and read it through over and over again until you get a sense of how everything fits together. Then just get started with specific words that seem to be the key ones in that particular passage, and then work outward in every direction until everything more or less fits together. That's how I approach a Barnhart anyway. I mean, from the beginning, initially, I mean.
And do you work sequentially from the first sentence, second sentence, third sentence, all the way through? Or would you kind of, if there's some ambiguity or there's some difficulty with the sentence, would you sort of skip forward a bit and then do
yes.
the next section and come back?
Yes, well, I do my best just to go through from beginning to end, but inevitably there are places where things are quite opaque, and then I have to move on. And quite often, everything that was opaque when I paused becomes clear in just a page or two later. So I have to keep sort of backtracking and jumping ahead. But I do my best to try to just move through.
I'd imagine there's lots of opportunities to revisit some of the same problems yeah. again.
Yeah.
No shortage of repeated motifs.
Certainly, yes. And if you want to know what about Barnhart specifically makes him more difficult than other German texts I've translated, because I wouldn't say he's the most difficult. Maybe someone like Adorno is even more difficult because more... The style is more constipated, even more constipated than Barnhart, by which I mean every possible resource that German allows that allows you to involute bits of the sentence into smaller bits of the sentence. Barnhart exploits those ruthlessly, but Adorno even more ruthlessly, to the point where there's no way you can come up with anything approximating an English sentence by sticking to the original at all closely. But with Barnhart, the main problem is these repetitions of specific words that aren't necessarily closely spaced, or they're not entirely closely spaced, so that a word that is of key importance in one part of the text will reappear much later. And you need to make sure you use the same word. You need to use the same English word as the one that you used 20 or 30 pages later or earlier, because even though the denotation might be approximately the same, there's a kind of force field in the text of 10 or 20 keywords, and you need to get those exactly right and exactly consistent if you at all possibly can.
So did you have those listed? Because I imagine across Bernhard that must be the case. Did you identify the words and have a sort of one sheet so that you knew that you were always consistent in the word that you used? Or does it not require that? Do you get so familiar with it?
It doesn't require it. I think, to be in all fairness, I've read so much Bernhard at this point that you get used to certain words. They're not generally unique to the specific text. They're unique to his corpus. So you're used to saying them in the context of the larger corpus. So just listing them doesn't particularly help. But remembering that they occur with particular frequency in this particular text is just something you have to keep in mind. More generally, it's a problem, I think, when you're thinking of these words in the context of the larger corpus and how other translators have dealt with them. So you've got to be faithful to your sense of what the word means, but also bear in mind how other people have rendered that particular word.
Are there any cases where you had to break that in terms that the words in German has different meanings that most of the way through you'd stuck with a particular English meaning, but then in some places Bernhard's used it in another sense that English word wouldn't work anymore and you have to replace it with something else?
Yes. A particularly good example is the various uses he puts the word Geist to. Geist is in spirit or intellect or mind. He uses it obsessively and in varying combinations. And in most cases, I tended to translate it as mind, but there are cases when it's used particularly in compounds where it sort of functions as an adjective, or when the adjectival derivation geistig is used, where I had to use intellect or intellectual instead. But there was genuinely no way around that, because the English adjectival derivative of mind, or at least semantically, is mental, and you can't use mental in the same way as you can intellectual. It obviously has certain connotations that don't overlap with intellectual and in Bernhard's case, generally the mind is the seat of intellect, of intellection, of ratiocination. I mean, at least in this particular book, I think you'll agree. So I couldn't be absolutely consistent in my use of translations of Geist.
Did you consult with any other the translators? Because there's sort of a handful of people, obviously, who've translated Bernhard into English that we have. Did you speak to anyone who'd done it before, or did have any of them sort of published any research or anything about it?
I have read Gita Honegger has an essay on some of her work on Bernhard. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She wrote the first biography of Bernhard in any language, as far as I know, because her biography is from about 18 years ago, and the German one is only about 5 years old. So, but she wrote an essay about her own translation work, translating Bernhard, and the work of other translators, and what she thought that they had done that she wouldn't have done. And so I have some sense of how other people have approached Bernhard up to a point. But a lot of the people who translated Bernhard so far are now no longer alive, so it's not possible to consult with them.
It's interesting that he's one of those writers that his style is so specific that there does feel, I mean, I think you can tell that obviously different translators are working on it, but there does feel like quite a consistency. It comes across as Bernhardian in English. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure there's other writers you could read where the translations really bring a different sort of flourish to it.
Yes. I mean, I noticed that in translations from the Russian. You read Dostoevsky, he's been translated by about 10 or 20 different translators over the past 120 years. And there's definitely a Victorian Dostoevsky and a sort of a noir 50s Dostoevsky, 1950s Dostoevsky. And then there's the more pedantic Dostoevsky of his more recent translators who sort of make it seem more Russian, or try to make it seem as Russian as they possibly can. And you're right. I mean, he's been translated by Bernhard by sort of a wide array of people. Some of them are like Honegger. She's a native Austrian speaker, a native German speaker, rather. Austrian, whose native language is German. And I believe the translator, previous translator of this book, of The Cheap Eaters, was also a native speaker of German. But his original translator, one of his earliest translators, Sylvia Wilkins, was, I think, an American. So he had been translated in both directions, as it were, from people who are more familiar with German and people who are more familiar with English, but still recognizably Bernhardian, I think, all the way through.
You mentioned, is it Oswald's Owers, I can't quite remember his name, is who had translated this previously and translated Yes, I think, the most commonly available copy of Yes. Did you read that original English translation, or did you feel that it was, you wanted to just bring your own versions, or fresh, as it were?
Well, no, I didn't read it, but the editor, my editor at Spurl, has read it. So she was able to refer to that. And if there were parts, places where she thought the first translation was somehow revealing in a way, we would compare them. Usually, I have to say, we would opt for the version I had already settled on, but sometimes the older translation was illuminating and offered a preferable alternative.
So you read Bernhard for a number of years. Was the majority of that reading in the original, or have you read English translations of other novels generally? And does the English versions you have read, do you feel there's any more of a kinship between your translation and the rest of the corpus compared with other translations that you've done? Does it feel like you've had to fit Cheap Eaters in with your knowledge of the rest of the English translations to keep with the sort of those key words, for example, and the style overall? Or is it similar to translating any other novel or work that you've worked on in the, you know, a distinct project?
I mean, if you're asking me which of the translations I tend to think of as the most authoritatively Bernhardian, or the ones that just read best in English, I think the earlier ones by Wilkins, and I can't remember some of the names of these people who translated the earlier novels like Gargoyles and Limeworks, I think I prefer those to the later ones a bit. They seem more to approximate a certain formal quality that I find in Bernhard. Not formal as in having to do with form, but a certain kind of etiquette or comportment. I think he's a little more old-fashioned than one might think from reading some of the more recent translations. So I think Wilkins, for example, also translated Musil. She's the one who translated the most recent version of The Man Without Qualities. And so you think of Musil as a figure of the very late Habsburg period. Somehow she's a good fit for Bernhard because she's a good fit for him, I think.
Were you sort of aware of these different translations while you were in the process of translating? Is that something that was somewhere in your mind, or is while you were translating, it's purely sentence by sentence, and that it's only sort of in retrospect or when you step back from the work that you're thinking about other translations?
I didn't have them in mind very much, except, well, yes, polemically, I think, in one respect, I had a specific practice that I think that's common to all, at least all the latest, the most recent ones, by which I mean the ones from the last 30 years, translations of Bernhard, is that they tend to be very sparing in their use of semicolons. So you must have noticed that these translations tend to consist of like a torrent of comma splices, gives it what people think of as a breathless quality that they think of as distinctively Bernhardian. But the fact is the semicolon isn't used very much in German at all by anyone. And I noticed this particular when I was reading Bernhard's correspondence with his publisher, Siegfried Unseld, who, you know, these are business letters, so you would expect that they'd adhere very punctiliously to all the rules of punctuation, and there were very, very few semicolons in those letters, and that led me to reflect, well, if this is an element that is missing from German just because it's not needed or thought to be needed in German, like, for example, the article in Russian, the definite and indefinite article, Dostoevsky's novel, The Idiot, that's known as The Idiot in English, is just idiot in Russian. So you have to put the A or the V in front. You have to decide whether you're just going to call it idiot, the idiot, a idiot. So
it would be quite a different novel if it was just called a idiot.
an idiot. Yeah, but I mean, it's conceived. You could call it. There's a great there's probably a very compelling case for calling it an idiot. If he's just one, he's not the definitive idiot. So conceivably, I'm not advocating it. But I'm saying so in punctuation, there's also, I think, a case that to be made that Bernhard doesn't use commas or semicolons. German readers might be able to put up with that. But since we use semicolons, since the comma splice is at least officially a solecism in English punctuation, it makes sense, I think, to put in semicolons where they would be called for. So that's probably my biggest innovation in relation to early translators is that I have thought it appropriate to put in semicolons to keep clauses distinct from each other, the independent clauses from each other within sentences. I think what other translators have done, according to Honegger, is break the sentences up to avoid that a lot of times. And I have almost never done that. Almost every one of my sentences corresponds to a single other sentence in the original.
That's interesting. So sort of stylistically, people might come to the Cheap Eaters, and if they're really particularly observant, saying, he started using different punctuation when he was writing this one.
Yes.
That's good to be able to leave your sort of stamp on it like that.
But then I think David McClintock, I noticed when I looked at his translation of Concrete, if you look at that, you'll see that he uses a lot of dashes. Now, I haven't seen the original of Concrete, but I'm sure the dashes are his way of dealing with the confusingness of the cascading commas. So you might also get the idea that Bernhard was suddenly fond of dashes in that novel, which for all I know he was, but I think it's more likely that was the translator's choice.
Damit auch das Vergnügen nach Jahren, der ich überhaupt nichts geschrieben habe, was mich nicht mehr interessiert hat.
I wanted to speak to you about your interest in Bernhard as well. You said that, did you say it was sort of the end of the 90s or something when you first read Bernhard, or it was a while ago? What book did you read first? What got you started on this?
I started with Wittgenstein's Nephew. It was just a book a friend of mine had recommended to me in connection, I think, with George Steiner's comparison of Bernhard to Musil and Kafka. And I just couldn't believe that there was any writer of whose life had overlapped with mine who could be considered in the same category as Musil and Kafka. And I was very pleasantly surprised to find that it had something of the same effect. And then I just went on to read the novels and novellas that were available in English.
Did you do that in quite a scattergun way, or did you go back to sort of Frost or Gargoyles and try from the beginning?
I had to do it in a scattershot fashion because of the way one had to get hold of books at the time. It happened to be that the big chain stores had four or five novels in translation, like the one known as The Loser, Der Untergeher, and Woodcutters, for example, was at my local library and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I just read them as I found them. And Frost wasn't even available until I think about 06. So I didn't read Frost until then.
So I have read other people treat Bernhard as having quite distinct phases, although I don't think I'm as sensitive to this as maybe other people or people who read him more academically are. But aside from the later novels where he focuses on different sort of art forms, would you say that The Cheap Eaters definitely belongs in sort of a middle period where he was doing something distinctly different?
No, I think the Cheap Eaters is definitely part of what I'd call late period, or it's the very beginning, almost the very beginning of the late period. The very first novel or novella from that period, I'd say, is Yes, and it's not that he's dealing with different topics. It's that his prose has organized itself in such a way that it fits best within texts of a certain length, of about 100 to 120 pages. Until then, he tended to write big novels interspersed with really short novels or novellas, really short, even short stories. And that had a lot to do with his style of his early period, which, as you have noticed, is sort of fragmentary and elliptical. It's less concentrated. But I think for some reason, with Correction, that novel that he wrote, the long novel from about 1975, that in that novel, he basically, his style stabilized and it became the kind of style of really long sentences, no ellipses, just monolithic chunks of prose. And for some reason, he only wrote one more novel, long novel, in that prose style. And that's the big one, the magnum opus, Extinction, which he finished, I think, in 81. It wasn't published till 86. But for some reason, he had this mature prose style that consisted of long monolithic blocks of prose that lent themselves to sort of short texts, you know, like very short novels. So that's where The Cheap Eaters fits in, I think. It's definitely the beginning of the late period.
Do you think there's a reason? I mean, this will probably be, in a creative sense, a dull answer to do with contract and things like that. But is there a reason that the Cheap Eaters hasn't been available for so long?
I really don't know. I know that, as we've discussed, there was a translation published in about 1990 by Quartet Books, and they still exist. I don't know why they allowed their translation to go out of print. It's really, I don't know how to explain why certain of the novels were translated more quickly. Obviously, at the beginning, they were just translating the big ones like Gargoyles and The Lime Works and Correction as they came out, and were mostly ignoring the shorter texts. But then, beginning in the early 80s, the shorter novels began to be translated, and I don't know why this one was sort of in the middle of that rush of translations, why it wasn't handled by the usual publishers like the University of Chicago or Knopf, and why it subsequently went out of print. I really don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a good reason for us to be celebrating the fact that it is back in print in your translation now. I'm sure there are people who just can't get on with Bernhard and really don't like what he's doing. But I think if he really gets under your skin, you just sort of want to read everything once you get to it. And the fact that there's been this kind of glaring gap in the sort of center of the bibliography is, I mean, I'm very glad that it's been addressed now. It feels distinct particularly, and this is very superficial, but that it's dealing with quite a kind of almost metropolitan setting in a way that Bernhard's other novels seem to be quite, like, in very rural locations, quite far away from civilization. If that probably sounds too derogatory, I say that as someone who grew up in a very little village. But this felt to be, yeah, quite a shift in where it was set.
Yes, in that way, it is quite distinctive in having this Viennese setting. That's very setting in which the city of Vienna is very prominent. It's true, old masters and woodcutters, which are also late works, do have sort of Viennese frames of reference, but they feel a bit more claustrophobic because you're always referring to a specific room in the Kunsthistorisches Museum, for example, in Old Masters, or at Woodcutters, you're at this dinner party in somebody's house most of the time. And so it's got that open air urban feel to it. That, I think, is completely distinct to it. The sense of walking around the city and in the various districts, the different restaurants, that definitely distinguishes it from everything else, I think.
Do you have much to sort of frame the translation from other writing of Bernhard? You mentioned his letter to his publisher, I think he said. Did you have other letters or anything that he was writing around the time that you gave any perspective or context on where this came from? I'm not familiar how much or little he had any notes sort of around ideas before a novel burst onto the page. But were you able to source any materials along those lines or use them at all in the translation?
I have no idea why he decided to write about this particular milieu, this Viennese milieu around this restaurant, the VPK, at this particular time. I know that he did frequent that restaurant, but in a much earlier period of his life, in the 50s. I got this from the biography in German, that he got a sort of allowance from Hedwig Stavianicek, the woman he calls his Lebensmensch, or his life, basically his life partner.
She was a woman quite a few years his senior.
She was a woman he met when he was recovering from a serious illness after the World War II, maybe around 1950, who sort of took him under her wing and helped him on his way to becoming professional writer through a lot of detours, like driving a beer truck and studying to become an actor. And in the 1950s, and this is another thing that's not quite evident from his corpus itself, is that he did spend a lot of time in Vienna in his 20s. And I mean, he lived there for quite a long time. And he maintained an apartment there, or it was actually her apartment, until his death. So he was shuttling back and forth from Vienna to the farmhouse out in Ohlsdorf in Upper Austria constantly. But anyway, in the 50s, she would give him some really tiny allowance every day, and he would go spend this tiny amount of money he had every day to get lunch at the VPK. So he had obviously had a great, strong attachment to that restaurant. I don't know why he had an antipathy to the other restaurant, the God's Eye. That I don't understand. That's a very different kind of restaurant, but I don't.
But also know why. A real place. Still.
Oh yeah, as in most of his writings, every single place name refers to a real place. So the God's Eye is a real place, and so is the Zirganitz, the other cafe that's mentioned only briefly.
Is that true? Did he have a connection in a similar way to most of the other places that he mentions? Is that unique in Cheap Eaters that he actually had spent time eating and going there on a daily basis?
Do you mean are the place names mostly associated with places he'd been to or had some close association?
Yeah, I mean, in his other novels, were the places that are mentioned, is there normally a close link in a similar way?
Yes. He embellished. I mean, I'm only realizing this now as I'm reading this diary of his neighbor. He embellished amazingly little. I mean, a lot of the events are straight out of this diary. A lot of the most grotesque events you see in the or the most outrageous events you read about in his work spring from things that happened that he witnessed or that people he knew had witnessed or experienced.
Did he end up getting prosecuted after either Old Masters or Woodcutters, or possibly from one of his plays, but essentially for libel or slander or something on those lines? Is that right?
Yes, after Woodcutters, because he just slightly altered the name of one of his old friends and from the 50s and made him describe him as a complete idiot. And a really lousy composer. This man's vocation. He thought of himself as the next Anton Webern or Anton Webern's heir and successor. But Bernhard, of course, trashed him as just a really lousy, pointless composer and an idiot to boot. And then so he sued him. And all Bernhard could say was, "Well, I didn't use that name, so the referent is—it's not the same person because that's not his name." But he didn't say it's not about him. So
it must be a tricky case to say. I mean, to say that's me—the person who is an idiot and is not a very good composer.
Right. I think he pointed that out as well. That it was funny that he was drawing this attention to his own stupidity. His target.
Wow, you got to double down on it once you get caught out for that, I guess. Do you know much about how his work is seen in Austria? And is his work still not able to be published by Austrian publishing houses?
Oh, no, they got around that. His publisher got around that, circumvented it pretty quickly. So it's readily available in Austria now. And I think, I don't know, as far as I know, his reputation is pretty strong in Austria still, I think pretty much he's a modern classic now. I don't know. I don't have a great deal of evidence of this. I just remember I ran into an Austrian at a cafe about 5 years ago who saw me reading some Bernhard, and he flashed me his copy of Concrete in the original German, and we started talking, and he was from Vienna and told me about how quintessentially Viennese Bernhard was. And so that's the kind of thing that suggests that he's still got a very strong reputation in Austria.
That's kind of good to know, I think. I do love the fact that you will probably know the German for this, and I don't have any German. But that, and this is something we mentioned to Olga Tokarczuk when we were speaking to her, the word that essentially means nest besmircher.
Yes.
The fact that this German is robust enough to have a word for that and for him to be sort of held up as, you know, potentially persona non grata because of what he's saying about Austrian society.
But of course, this is something Austria does tolerate more maybe than Germany, that there are these figures that that are universally reviled but treasured at the same time, like, for example, Karl Kraus before him. Yes, it's funny that it's basically been institutionalized, this function.
A really important civic role to be the person that everyone's mad at because you're disrespecting your home. Maybe it's an important pressure valve. Maybe we need it here.
Right. Who knows? That's the thing. You can't just will yourself to be that kind of person. Or, I mean, it wasn't opposed by any means. It was just sort of his personality made him do these things that were found. I mean, of course, he delighted in it, but it wasn't something he was just doing for the sake of annoying people.
Is sort of tied into the sort of Austrian the mannerisms, and it is about Austria. Do you still? I find it hard to picture, say, Thomas Bernhard being born somewhere else, next to a beach. I can't imagine him just kicking back and relaxing. It is something intrinsic, I imagine, to him as a person, that he would have been find these annoyances and these issues wherever he was.
Right, as he says, he sees himself as quintessentially Austrian, but he can't stand the country, so he hates it, but he never wants to leave it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess being a German speaker, there's other places he could have gone to, but he seems to have very much settled and stayed there, didn't he?
Right, yeah. yes. But of course, he doesn't seem to have had any affection for other parts of the German-speaking world. I mean, it's not like a lot of Austrians before the war, a lot of Viennese yearned to live in Berlin and ended up moving there. But for him, I think Germany is just it's just an incredibly prosaic, stodgy, bureaucratic place.
Obviously, if people are listening to this and they haven't read any Thomas Bernhard, the first place we would advise them to go to is the Cheap Eaters. What book would you suggest, if that's the first place someone goes, what book of his would you suggest someone goes to afterwards?
I would say either, it depends on whether you're in the mood for a really long read, in which case I would go to Extinction, which really remains his masterpiece, I think, in drawing everything together from the earlier books. And then you can go back to those and sort of see how they all lead up to Extinction, or maybe Wittgenstein's Nephew as an alternative if you want something shorter that overlaps with the Cheap Eaters in a lot of ways, because again, it's dealing with this sort of Viennese celebrity, Paul Wittgenstein, but dealing with it in a different way, as from the point of view of a memoirist rather than in the context of a fictional narrative or narrative-like text.
That sounds like good recommendations. I haven't yet read Extinction. I'm sort of saving it for probably the end. I've got Concrete and Extinction to go of the ones that are sort of readily available now that Cheap Eaters is ticked off. Yeah, that's good to know that you have enthusiasm for it, and it's not like, oh, that was just the work he churned out towards the end and it's long and stodgy. That sounds good.
No. He deliberately postponed it, I think, to the end. He wrote it, even the ones he wrote after it, he was thinking of as building up to it. That's the amusing, or striking, at any rate, reflection, I think.
Well, thank you to Douglas for joining us over the transatlantic fiber optic cables at some point in the turn of the year.
And thank you for joining us via whatever connection of technology brought this podcast to you. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, we must just say that if you're listening to this now in mid-March, Douglas's translations of The Cheap Eaters is out now on Spurred Editions, and I believe is distributed in this country and around the world.
Yeah. You should go out and buy it, or go online and buy it if you're in the UK and are not allowed to go out.
The times are a-changing. Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to know more about me and my writing, I'm at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, and my website is jamiebatchen.com, where you can find out all about my novel Siphonophore.
And you can find me at LachlanBloom.com or on Twitter at LachlanBloom. And do follow us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods, or you can find all the latest episodes at unsignedmethods.co.uk or on Audioboom or wherever you find your podcasts.
Dankeschön und auf Wiedersehen.